You're listening to According to Sam, episode 99. All right, folks, welcome to According to Sam. This is episode 99. Thank you so much for listening. It's only taken me 3 years to get here, episode 99, pushing up on my 100th episode. I've really enjoyed doing this podcast. I'm going to keep it going. I'll probably get to my 200th episode a lot faster than my 100th episode. I have a lot of things that I'm working on. I'll tell you a little bit more in the next podcast. But I really appreciate you guys that have been listening over the last 3 years and new listeners that I'm picking up. I try to mix it up here on the podcast and make it entertaining. Do the current events and news stories of the day, and there's a lot of those today. If I have some time at the end of the podcast, I will get back into some of those current events and COVID-19 mandates and stuff of that nature. But as I promise, and what I try to do on this show is mix it up and do these history lessons. I love history. I love teaching and telling people about history and tying history together. And I've been telling the history of the founding of the United States, going back, weaving in and out of the history along with the current events and other news. But going back to my 89th episode, so the past 10 episodes, like I said, weaving in and out, I've been telling this history of the founding of the United States of America. And we started telling this history going back to the Roman Empire. I'm going to get back into that history today. If you haven't listened to my past podcast and you want to listen to the beginning of this history lesson, it starts in episode 89. You can find the entire archive on my website. That's According to Sam with the number 2.com. Again, According to Sam with the number 2.com. You'll find the show archive there. You can also find the show on any platform that you get your podcast, Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, all by doing a search for According to Sam with the number 2. And you should find the show archive on any of those platforms as well. With that said, I want to get right back into this history, but I want to start with this clip. It's a clip of a girl on TikTok, just some random girl on TikTok. And it's interesting with all of these different media platforms where you can live stream and build a following and create content. Anyone has the ability to gather followers and promote their message. And this is just some random person on TikTok. And you may be asking, why do you even care what this random person on TikTok is saying? Is because the point of view that this girl is going to express on this TikTok video that I'm getting ready to play is a very prevalent point of view. And after you hear it, you'll understand why I'm playing it, because it's a great lead-in as we get back into this history. Because I think that there's a prevailing ignorance in this country. And, you know, when you live in a society where information is as accessible and at how fast you can access it, like our society today, a society unlike any society throughout millennia of human history, there's never been societies that can transmit information and access information like our society today. And it's really weird that there is this prevailing ignorance in our society. But historical ignorance is one of those prevailing ignorances. It is definitely expressed here in this video. Let's take a listen to the TikTok girl and we'll get started with today's podcast.
So earlier this week, I made a post saying that it doesn't sit right with me that there are white people who own property, multiple properties at that, in the United States of America, why black and indigenous people are experiencing homelessness. And I want to expand on that, especially for my new followers who are white, who followed me because of my anti-racist content. I'm glad that you're listening to me, but I really want to make sure that you're hearing what I'm saying. There will never be black liberation or indigenous sovereignty as long as the United States of America exists. If you want black folks around the globe and in this country liberated, if you want indigenous folks to be able to have sovereignty over the lands that they're indigenous to, then the United States of America needs to cease to exist. And I don't know if y'all are ready for that. I don't know if that's what y'all signed up for. I'm not sure if anti-racist work is just something you do to lessen the inconvenience of racism in your life, but I hope you're ready for this. It's not for the weak.
So that's her message to her new white followers. Could you imagine being a white person and following, but choosing to follow this person, to click onto her page and choose, and being a white person and choose to follow her? But she says, I don't know what your deal is. Are you following me just to alleviate yourself of some white guilt? I don't know, you know, what you think this is, but I'm making it clear. What my mission here is on my page is I believe in eliminating the United States of America from the face of this planet, that the United States of America cannot exist and achieve this global equity or global justice for indigenous and black people. She looks like she could be Afro-Latina. Her name is Sharky Marie on the TikTok. She has about 5,000 followers. It's not great, but 5,000 people have chosen to follow Sharky Marie, and she realizes that a lot of her new followers are white, and she wants to make it clear that what her mission is with her page is to eliminate the United States of America from the face of this earth. And people are choosing, at least 5,000 people have chosen to follow her. I tell you this, I know for a fact that this mindset that she is expressing is very prevalent. I'm surprised she doesn't have more followers. Maybe her page hasn't really kicked off yet. But there's an audience for this. I know for a fact that there's an audience for this. This is why they want to teach your children the 1619 Project. This is why they want to teach critical race theory. They've been teaching this. This is why this idea is so prevalent, because they've been teaching this for decades, and parents finally started to figure out what's going on in schools and start showing up at the PTA meetings. And the Justice Department is going to be showing up at the PTA meetings now too. Because they don't want you complaining about the fact that this mindset is being taught to your children. And that's why this idea is so prevalent, and that's why there's an audience for this type of thinking. The fact that the United States has to cease to exist. Do you know what this world would be like without the United States of America? And you're saying that the United States of America needs to cease to exist for there to be some global equity or global justice? It's a very, very ignorant point of view. And I have no idea what it's rooted in. These are the same people that believe in migration today, that all of these people from all over the world have the right to migrate to the United States. I mean, you don't think that Europeans had the right to migrate to the New World? And that's always a huge thing, the Indigenous Peoples Day or Columbus Day. Many states have, they've basically you know, Columbus Day's gone. They only celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. Some states celebrate both. But, you know, I don't really have a problem with it. Of course, there were Indigenous people in North America when Europeans came here. And, you know, for them, celebrating Columbus's arrival and the arrival of colonial powers may be a sore subject and something that they don't want to celebrate. So celebrating Indigenous people, that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. But if you start taking this to a point of view that the United States has to cease to exist, so there's some type of equity for colonialism, is a completely ignorant point of view. You cannot get more anti-colonial than the United States of America. The rebels who rebelled against the English colony to create the United States of America, they were more anti-colonial power than any of you frauds that are running around espousing your anti-colonialism. The rebels who fought against King George in the late 18th century were anti-colonial. As a matter of fact, their defeat of King George was the very first defeat of a colonial power, and it set a fire for many other people around the world to rebel against that colonial power. I mean, that's why I'm doing this history lesson. That's the whole reason that I'm doing this history lesson, because we are confronted today with, you know, just historical ignorance and basically manipulation and indoctrination on every level of our educational institutions. And I'm doing this history lesson to combat that. So let's get back into it. Now, we started in the Roman Empire. We started with the Nerva Antonine Dynasty. This was a period between 96 AD and 192 AD. This was the golden age of the Roman Empire, a period that is known as Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. And also known in this period is the Five Good Emperors. And these Five Good Emperors are what marked this golden age, because you had stability, you had, you know, peace, Pax Romana. You had all these things that were going on, expansion, all these things that were going on, contributing to what a lot of historians refer to today as the happiest time to be alive in human history. If you lived in the Roman Empire during Pax Romana, you would have lived in the happiest time in all of human history to be alive, according to some historians. Now, what happened to the golden age? Why, you know, this is just like I talk about the United States all the time, this period of a zenith, this golden age. And then when you can see that a nation is in, or an empire is in obvious decline. So what happened to end that period of peace and prosperity and the golden age of Rome, to where you are noticing the decline in Rome? And what happened was, the second to the last emperor in the Nerva Antonine Dynasty, Marcus Aurelius, when he dies, he did not, I'll tell you what. So Hadrian is the third emperor, and the period is called the time of the Five Good Emperors, but there's actually seven emperors in this dynasty. Two of the emperors are not included in the Five Good Emperors, Commodus, of course, and Hadrian is the second emperor. in this dynasty. And Hadrian starts to think ahead about after he dies and how he's going to be succeeded. Now, I want to talk about succession because succession crises in all of the history that we've talked about in this series of history lessons about the founding of the United States that I've been doing, we've been talking about succession crises. That's the a huge issue, no matter if we're talking about in the Roman Empire or if we're talking about Islam and after Muhammad dies and the caliphates, you're going to see how succession creates problems when we start talking about medieval Europe and Charlemagne, after Charlemagne dies. Succession has been a huge problem throughout human history. That's why this country, the United States of America, that people want to wipe from the face of the earth, that's why it's so unique. That's why we boast of a peaceful transfer of powers, because for 240 years, we have been able to boast about a peaceful transfer of power. And if you know anything about human history, you would know how rare a peaceful transfer of power is and how often succession crises happened when a great ruler or even a not so great ruler dies. And, I know what you're saying. Go January 6th. No, but think about this. This is what these people. So I was just talking about these people who rebelled against colonial powers, King George, how they were anti-colonial. You read their writings, read Common Sense. They were anti-colonial. And what you got to understand is that America is what came after colonialism. They defeated the colonial power, and then they all met to come up with a new government. And a lot of them not only were anti-colonial, they were anti-federal as well. Anti-federalists. So that's important. And we're going to get to that history. But they created a system, a constitutional republic. We're not a democracy. And that's really important. All of this history that we're talking about in the Roman Empire and European history that we're going to get to, these guys, they knew all that history really well, and they were considering it. And they were considering the fact that succession crises were the thing that brought down great empires, and how succession crises had been a huge problem throughout history. So they're the ones who strategize that 2 weeks before the actual transfer of power, which is on January 20th, you hash out who you're going to transfer that power to. So January 6th, everything that went on in Congress, the challenging of the electoral votes that members of the House did and members of the Senate, and going and hearing the objection to the electoral votes and then voting on that, that's all constitutional. There was nothing anti-democratic about that. About the fact that these guys in Congress were challenging the electoral votes. All that stuff was designed, though, to be hashed out on January 6th. So on January 20th, you have a peaceful transfer of power, which we did on January 20th. It went off without a hitch. I mean, power was transferred from Trump to Biden. It went off without a hitch. And everything that went on in Congress on January 6th was constitutional. The Electoral College chooses the President of the United States. That's why, if you really understand what went on with January 6th and how the protesters were led into the Capitol to disrupt the process, they wanted them to disrupt the process. They wanted them to disrupt the process because everything that was going on inside was constitutional, completely constitutional. Anyway, so the peaceful transfer of power is so, I mean, and it's something that makes us completely unique amongst a lot of other things in this world, the United States of America, who you want to eliminate from the face of the earth. So Hadrian, in the Roman Empire, people realize this. I mean, Hadrian, who was the third emperor in the Nerva Antonine dynasty, he started thinking about his succession before he died. And it was really common in the Roman Empire for emperor who didn't have a male heir to adopt a male heir and groom them to succeed them. I mean, Julius Caesar adopted Octavian. It happened many other times after that. So Hadrian, he gets the idea about who's going to succeed him after he dies, and he adopts a man by the name of Antonius, and Antonius was groomed to succeed Hadrian. But Hadrian not only was thinking about his successor, he was thinking about even who Antonius, who the successor of Antonius would be, and Hadrian worked it out to where Antonius would adopt two young boys while Hadrian was still alive, thinking, you know, two successions down the way. And Antonius adopts a boy by the name of Lucius and Marcus Aurelius. And both of these young boys grow up as brothers. They're groomed in the classical Greek philosophy. They're groomed to be emperors. And when Antonius dies, Marcus Aurelius becomes the emperor. And then he chooses his brother, Lucius, to rule with him. And for the first time in Roman history, you have dual emperors, two different emperors ruling together. And if that makes you think of Diocletian and Maximian, it should, because it's really interesting that these co-rulers, for the first time, Marcus Aurelius and Lucius ruled together. And then after Marcus Aurelius dies, you start to see the decline of the Roman Empire. And then when Diocletian pulls it all together again, he rules as a co-emperor with his brother in arms, Maximian. There were other co-rulers throughout the third century crisis as well, a few, but Marcus Aurelius and Lucius were the very first co-rulers, and they were, and it's interesting because they were groomed together, they were adopted together by Antonius, and it only really made sense. I mean, at that time, the empire was growing, it was massive, it needed to be ruled by two emperors. I don't know what Marcus Aurelius was thinking when he died, and you know, he leaves this vast empire to his idiot son Commodus, but to rule by himself. I mean, if anything, he should have been thinking ahead like Hadrian and picked another co-ruler to rule with Commodus, if he left Commodus as a ruler at all. But Lucius is the other emperor in the seven emperors in the Nerva Antonine dynasty who is not included in the five good emperors. And those emperors are Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antonius, Lucius, Marcus Aurelius, and Commodus. So I've related Commodus to Hunter Biden often, and that's I mean, it's kind of a good relationship that you can think of today, that if Joe Biden, no matter what you think about Joe Biden, he's not half the man Marcus Aurelius was. But if Joe Biden suddenly dies, and then Hunter Biden automatically becomes the president of the United States or the leader of America, it would be kind of in that vein. Lucius dies of either food poisoning or smallpox, whatever you want to believe, about 10 years before Marcus Aurelius. And if Lucius would have outlived Marcus Aurelius, Roman history, this golden age, may have lasted longer, because Lucius probably would have been the sole emperor and Commodus would have been shut out. But Lucius dies a decade before Marcus Aurelius, and then Marcus Aurelius kind of rules together with Commodus for a few years before Marcus Aurelius dies, and Commodus becomes the sole emperor. And Commodus was a buffoon. And the stability that you had with the five good emperors ends, and that's what leads to the downfall, when you don't have a good emperor, when you don't have good leadership. In the year after Commodus is assassinated, because he's assassinated, you had a succession crisis. You had, in 1 year, you had five emperors of Rome, one after the other, seizing power, usurping. And then Septimius Severus becomes the emperor, and he's starts the Severan dynasty, but the ball was rolling downhill at that point. And within about 30 years from that point, the last emperor of the Severan dynasty is assassinated, and that kicks off the third century crisis. And we talked about the third century crisis and everything that was about. You have the barbarian invasion, you had the civil wars, you had rebellions, and parts of the empire breaking off and declaring their independence. You had plague, debasement of currency, economic depression. You had all of these problems in the Roman Empire during the third century crisis. But all of these crises, basically, if you really understand this, it all came down to the fact that there was no stability. There was no stable leadership and someone to administrate the bureaucracy and to keep the peace and to take care of the problems. You don't have a chance to take care of all of these problems that are going on in the empire when you're constantly looking over your shoulder, when, you know, you're not around very long because you're assassinated or usurped or whatever. I mean, in the first 50 years of the third century crisis, you had about 30 different Roman emperors. That's how fast people were dying. The real problem was the problem of succession that took place during the Roman period of the third century crisis, or the crisis of the third century. So we talked about all of that, and we talked about how at the end of the crisis of the third century that, Valerian is the first who starts to take care of some of these problems. And Valerian actually, he, within the period of the crisis of the third century, he had one of the longest reigns as emperor. I think he reigned for 7 years. He wasn't assassinated or usurped either. He was captured in battle by the Persians and ended up, the Persians ended up killing him. He ruled with his son together, co-emperors, and his son became emperor when he died, but not for very long, because I believe his son was assassinated. And let's see how he died. Assassination. So Valerian's son Gallienus was assassinated. And then Illyrian later on becomes emperor. And Illyrian is the guy who really actually starts to repair a lot of the problems that were going on in the crisis of the third century. He unites the two areas that had split off and declared their independence. He wins battles against them and then brings them back into the empire. He takes on the barbarians and defeats the barbarians. Honestly, if Illyrian would have lived and would have worked out the succession crisis beyond himself and was able to, die a peaceful death in his old age and hand off power to another emperor, I think that you would say that the crises of the third century would have ended with Illyrian, and he would have gotten credit for it. But yet Illyrian was assassinated by his own men. And then Diocletian comes along, and then Diocletian is the one who actually gets credit for ending the third century crisis, because he creates tetrarchy. He first rules with his brother-in-arms, Maximian, and then they work it out to where he and Maximian would have junior emperors, and those junior emperors would, after they retired, they wouldn't even die as emperor. Diocletian actually retired and went to, become a farmer on his villa. The junior emperors, they come and they take over the empire. And the empire was essentially split into the east and the west. The western emperor was a man by the name of the junior emperor Maximian, who became the emperor when Maximian retired. That was a man by the name of Constance. He had a son by the name of Constantine, and Constantine eventually unites the entire empire under his rule. After we went through all the history and covered that, we talked about Constantine embracing Christianity. We talked about Christianity from its inception in a Roman outpost in the Levant, we talked about bishops, the bishops of Rome, how the Bishop of Rome became the Pope. We talked about Constantine after he won the Battle of the Melvin Bridge, after embracing Christianity, moves the empire from the west to the east and establishes the new great Christian city of Constantinople, and the Byzantine Empire begins. We talked about Theodosius. We talked about Theodosius being the last emperor to rule a a joint empire, both East and West, and he was a great Christian emperor. We talked about Christianity going from a persecuted religion in the Roman Empire to a huge, not only spiritual, but political force within the Roman Empire. We talked about, the Council of Nicaea and apostasy and the Nicene Creed. We talked about Clovis. We talked about how once Constantine moved the capital to the east and established the Byzantine Empire and the great city of Constantinople, that he kind of abandoned the western part of the empire, and barbarians, these Germanic tribes from on the other side of the Danube and Rhine River, they begin to cross into the Roman Empire. They begin to settle into the Roman Empire. They begin to be incorporated into Roman society and the Roman military. We talked about one particular tribe. It's not just one tribe, but this was a group of tribes that this one king, Clovis the First, he got all of these tribes together and united them under the one name, the Franks. And he converted into Christianity. We talked about that, and that fact that you had all of these other Germanic tribes coming in and converting into Christianity, but some of them were converting into Arianism. And the really important thing about Clovis's conversion is that Clovis was converting into Chalcedon or the Nicene form of Christianity. So we talked about all of that. And then after Clovis, we went to the Arabian desert and started talking about Islam and how Islam had started with Muhammad and the angel Gabriel and the downloads, the revelations that Muhammad would get, which basically established the writings in the Quran, these downloads from the angel Gabriel. And we talked about how Muhammad went to Medina. He was chased out of Mecca to Medina. He went to Medina, built this huge following, went back into Mecca, took over Mecca, took over the Kaaba, established the fact that there was no God but God, and that Allah, Muhammad was the prophet of Allah. And they not only took over Mecca, they took over the entire Arabian desert. And then Muhammad dies. We talked about what happened after Muhammad dies, the Rashidun Caliphate, how all of Muhammad's his family members from Ali and his daughter, they were all killed. They were all murdered by Muslims, by Umayyads. And after the Rashidun Caliphate, which was the caliphate of the rightly guided caliphs, after that, that's created the split of the Sunni and the Shia, and that was the start of the Umayyad Caliphate. Under Omar, we talked about under Omar how Omar was the second of the rightly guided caliphs, and Islam starts to expand out of the Arabian desert under Omar. They take over all of the Levant, Jerusalem, Palestine, Syria. They defeat the Byzantine army. They defeat all of the Persian army and take over all of what is present day Iraq, you know, all the way to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and then they push into Africa and they start taking over North Africa. And this is all pretty much done under Omar. So when the Umayyads, when they come to power and their caliphate is in charge, the Umayyads, they push even further into North Africa. And the influence on Africa by Islam is something that you really have to understand, because before Islam came into North Africa, I mean, it was a much different place before Islam and after Islam. So, I mean, even to this day, the influence of Islam is all over Africa. All over Africa. But what I'm telling you, there was a time period before the 7th century where there was not a single trace of Islam. There was no Islam anywhere in Africa. And now Islam is prevalent throughout all of Africa. So the influence of Islam on Africa is something that is very, very important to understand. The northern part of Africa had been ancient Egypt. It had been Carthage. It had been part of the Roman Empire. These are advanced societies. The library in Alexandria was probably one of the greatest libraries in human history before it was destroyed. These are not backwater nomadic people from the Sahara Desert. These are some of the greatest societies in human history. Take a look at Carthage and how advanced Carthage was before the Romans conquered them. These are the people who Islam were confronting when they came into North Africa. At this time, the Vandals basically dominated North Africa. The Vandals were one of these dramatic tribes that came over the Danube and Rhine rivers. The Vandals had actually sacked Rome after the Visigoths, and then they went to Spain, and then from Spain, North Africa, and the Muslims made easy work of them. They went all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, and then not only to the Atlantic Ocean, but starting to move across the Atlantic Ocean and Mediterranean at Gibraltar into Spain. And that's where I want to pick up with this clip. Take a listen.
Rabat, the capital of modern Morocco. It was here in 708 that the armies of the Umayyad Caliph Al-Walid reached the Atlantic coast. After more than 50 years of fierce resistance by local Berber tribes, the Muslims had finally conquered the whole of North Africa. Having been conquered, the Berbers discovered that Islam had much to offer and began to convert and assimilate. One of them, Tariq ibn Ziyad, was about to write his name in history. Jabal Tariq, the mountain of Tariq, Gibraltar, southern tip of the Iberian Peninsula. It was here in the spring of 711 that Tariq's army of Berbers landed after crossing the Mediterranean. Inside 3 years, he had toppled the Visigoth rulers and secured almost total control of the peninsula, turning it into a caliphal province known as Andalusia.
Andalusia. Al-Andalusia, the land of the Vandals. And this was a name given to the Iberian Peninsula from the Berbers who lived across the Strait of Gibraltar. And they called it the land of the Vandals because, like I said, the Vandals were this German tribe who had come over, and a group of tribes who went under the name Vandals, but they would came across from the Germanic area into the Roman area, raiding all over Gaul. They ended up sacking Rome. They sacked Rome after the Visigoths. And the Visigoths were another Germanic tribe, group of tribes who went under the name Visigoths. The Visigoths are actually incorporated into the Roman military. I mean, they worked with the Roman Empire closely for a period of time. The Roman Empire basically used them and mistreated them, so they ended up breaking off and then went about sacking cities and town all over the Roman Empire. The Visigoths first sacked the city of Rome, and it was a light sacking. They basically take a bunch of gold and treasure. They leave the buildings intact and you know, don't violate the women or anything like that, and then they take off. When the Vandals come along and sack Rome, they give Rome a good sacking. But both of these Germanic tribes sack Rome, go around sacking and raiding throughout the empire, and then they both eventually end up in Spain. The Vandals first, and then the Visigoths come along later. When the Visigoths come into Spain, they end up chasing the Vandals out, along with a couple of other Germanic tribes who had settled in Spain. They would all go and settle, all these Germanic tribes, they would go and settle in Spain, because Spain was this remote peninsula. It was hidden by the Pyrenees Mountains. The Roman Empire was, you know, bogged down with, you know, conflicts and things that were going on in other areas of the empire. So all these Germanic tribes felt like they could go and hide in Spain. So when the Visigoths get there, there's other Germanic tribes there. They chase them all out, and then they basically controlled the entire Iberian Peninsula, and they create the Kingdom of the Visigoths. So the Andalus is called the Land of the Vandals, probably because when the Vandals, when they were chased out of Spain, they crossed the Strait of Gibraltar into Africa, and that's how they came to occupy North Africa. And the Vandals were probably the first people from the area of Spain that the Berbers made contact with, and that's why they called it Al-Andalus. When the Berbers, the Umayyad Berbers, Tariq, when he crossed the Strait of Gibraltar into Spain for the first time in 711, he was just going to go check it out. You know, the Visigoth kingdom had been in this area for about 200 years at this time, and they were going through a crisis. What do you think their crisis was, and what do you think that it had to do with? I'm going to tell you, it was succession, because everything in history, when you see a crisis going on in a nation or an empire, it always deals with succession. And that is what was going on with the Visigoths when Tariq and his small group of Berbers crossed over into the Visigoth area. And the Visigoths were not ready for this invasion. And this is why. Take a listen.
The great failure of the Visigoths was their inability to establish a hereditary succession. Civil war was a constant feature of their rule and played a key role in the rather rapid collapse of the kingdom to the Muslim invaders.
So this was the Visigoth kingdom that Tariq stumbled upon when he crossed the Strait of Gibraltar, a Visigoth kingdom that was not stable at all, engulfed in civil wars, succession crises. They didn't have a codified solution to succession, and it was a bunch of infighting. They'd been there for 200 years, and it was about time for the Visigoths to be conquered. They were not conquered totally, but shortly after crossing the Strait of Gibraltar, Tariq encounters the then king of the Visigoth, Roderic, and the Muslims kill Roderic. They kill most of his nobles, and then after that, that battle takes place at the southernmost part of Spain. After that, Tariq and the Berbers end up just pushing north and taking over the entire peninsula. A Umayyad governor from North Africa brings another large army over to join Tariq, and they quickly take over the entire peninsula in a little bit over a decade. After taking over the entire peninsula of Spain so rapidly, they begin to move past the Pyrenees Mountains into southern France and begin to attempt to take France. Now, let's talk about what was going on in France, because the Muslims, they had taken Spain so fast and so rapidly because the Visigoths were, engulfed in civil wars and unprepared and disorganized and didn't have any stability. So when the Muslims cross over the Pyrenees into France, they're thinking to themselves that we're going to take France as easily as we took Spain. Now, remember the philosophy that was generated around Muslim conquest at this time, because when the Muslims spilled out of the Arabian desert under Omar, and after the death of Muhammad, they took on the Persians, a great empire. They took on the Byzantine Romans, a great empire, defeated all of them. They defeated and took over all of North Africa, easily. And now they were in Spain, taking that over easily. And this concept that started to be articulated, Dar al-Islam, House of Islam, and Dar al-Harb, House of War, this concept was a way to explain what was going on, this rapid takeover of all of this area by the Islamic hordes. And they explained it that it was of God, that all of the area that is ruled by Muslims is under Sharia law, under God's law. And that's the House of Islam. And all of the areas of the world yet to be conquered is the House of War. And we must jihad, wage war to conquer those lands for God, to bring them under Sharia law. So they had quickly taken over Spain and now crossed over into the Pyrenees, and they were settled there, and they were prepared to take over France. This was the first time the Muslims had stepped foot into Europe when they took over Spain, and they were threatening to take over all of Europe. Now, let's talk about what was going on in France. Now, we talked about Clovis, the great king who united the four tribes under the kingdom of the Franks. And he had converted into Christianity, into the Chalcedon Nicene form of Christianity. The Visigoths were Christian as well, but the Visigoths were They were Aryan. Like most of the Germanic tribes, most of them were Aryan and had converted into Christianity, into Aryan Christianity. I think a Visigoth king finally converted into Catholicism in the 6th century, but they were Aryan. The Franks had been Nicene Christians from the beginning, from their earliest conversion, and because of Clovis, which will be important, and you'll see why. But they had their own succession crises in France, and it's really interesting. Take a listen to this clip. It's a clip about what was going on in France when the Muslims began to invade France, and the succession crises that was going on in France.
Clovis and his descendants in the Merovingian dynasty had made the Franks the most powerful barbarian group in Europe in the 6th century, able to defeat the Goths, for example, and push them south of the Pyrenees Mountains. However, there was a fatal flaw in the Merovingian kingdom of the Franks, and that involved the issue of succession.
It's always succession.
The later Roman Empire also had a problem with succession in that there was no single clear principle of succession. The problem in Merovingian Francia was somewhat different. There was a clear principle of succession, but it actually worked against Merovingian control. Merovingian kings regarded their kingdoms as part of their personal patrimony, something that they could divide up among their heirs when one of them died. And so when Clovis dies, he will divide up the kingdom of the Franks among his sons. They will inevitably fight with one another in an attempt to gain control of all the lands that had once belonged to their father. And as a result, the political history of Merovingian Francia is a bewildering kaleidoscope of different kingdoms coming into existence, being absorbed again into a single kingdom. At any given time, there were often three major kingdoms in existence, known as Neustria, which is where the Merovingians themselves came from, Austrasia, which was further to the east of Neustria, located on the Rhine River Valley, and Burgundy in central France.
So he says that there was a succession crisis in France as well, but it wasn't quite like the succession crises in Visigoth Spain, or even in the Roman Empire. This was a unique succession crisis because instead of leaving the entire kingdom or empire to one successor, what the Franks did is, if you had multiple children, you would divide up parts of the kingdom and divvy it up between your children. And after you die, inevitably, the children would go to war with one another, splitting up the empire. And it was weakening the monarchy in France. And the same thing was going on in France that was going on in Spain, but there was a unique difference that I'll tell you about here in a moment. The civil wars, the infighting, battles for power to take over your siblings' neighboring kingdom and incorporate it into your kingdom, that was weakening the Merovingian dynasty. And if it was going to be left up to the Merovingian dynasty to defend France when the Muslims started to invade France, it's very likely that France would have been conquered. But in weakening the power of the Merovingian monarchs, there was a group of aristocrats throughout these different separate parts of the Frankish kingdom. And these aristocrats were getting very rich, and they were very powerful, and they were the real power in France when the Muslims came to power. Let's listen to a little bit more of this clip. This guy explains exactly what I just told you.
The warfare among various members of the Merovingian family as they sought to consolidate the various kingdoms into one was very bad for Merovingian power for a number of reasons. When Merovingians went to war with one another to reclaim what had once belonged to their father, they had to bid for the support of important aristocratic families who would withhold their support until they were cut a sweet deal, usually in the form of lands, for example, or money. And
this further weakened the monarchy, too. The monarchy was not only weakened by the splitting up of the kingdom when a king dies, but also they were losing land because they were bribing these aristocrats to go to fight with them. And these aristocrats, like I said, they were getting rich.
When Merovingians went to war with one another to reclaim what had once belonged to their father, they had to bid for the support of important aristocratic families who would withhold their support until they were cut a sweet deal, usually in the form of lands, for example, or money. And the Carolingians are one of those Frankish aristocratic families that are able to enrich themselves at the expense of the Merovingians because of this Merovingian propensity for civil war.
So the Carolingians were one of the noble families, and they were the real power in France they weren't the real power. They were one of the noble families, aristocratic families, throughout the various Frankish kingdoms who had power. But they were definitely one of the leading aristocratic families in France during the early 8th century. Here's a little bit more about exactly how the Carolingians became so powerful, the title that they received, the mayor of the palace, and what that title, the power that title gave them. Take a listen.
Between the 630s and the 660s, matters grew even worse for the Merovingians because of bad dynastic luck. It just so happened that during these decades, the Merovingian kingdoms experienced a series of royal minorities, which is to say a series of periods in which the ruling king was a child under the age of 12, which is the age at which you are able to rule in your own name. And periods of minority were very bad for ruling dynasties because it was fairly easy for aristocratic families such as the Carolingian family to cajole these young rulers into making concessions that they ought not to have made. In return for a lollipop or sweets, you would be granted a major estate or an important monastery or the right to collect taxes in a certain region. And Frankish aristocratic families exploited this series of royal minorities to weaken Merovingian control still more. The actual running of the Frankish government during the period of minorities from the 630s to the 660s fell into the hands of important government officials known as the mayors of the palace. And this is the case in all of the various Frankish kingdoms. The mayor of the palace was responsible for the day-to-day operations of the Frankish government. He oversees the Frankish bureaucracy. The mayor of the palace controls access to Merovingian rulers as well, determines who gets to see the Merovingian king or not see the Merovingian king, and really determines the agenda for the whole of the Frankish government. Perhaps even more importantly, the mayor of the palace controls the appointments to various important offices within the Frankish kingdoms. The mayor of the palace decides who gets to be count, for example, if the last count dies, who gets to be duke, which is an even higher office than count, decides who gets to be abbot of an important monastery when the last abbot dies, decides who gets to be bishop. If you have the power to control these appointments, then you have the ability to fill the Frankish church and the Frankish government with your own supporters, rewarding them. And the loyalty of those whom you appoint will often be directed towards you rather than towards the Merovingian king. The Carolingians are mayors of the palace in Austrasia, and they exploit their position as mayors of the palace to build up a power base within this region.
So the Carolingians were the real power in Austrasia, at least. They would soon be the real power in all of France, but first they had to take care of the invading Muslims. Now, when the Muslims invaded, they didn't invade France first. They invaded the Duchy of Aquitaine, and Aquitaine wasn't part of the French kingdom, but it would be, and it is today. This is another clip about what happened after the Muslims entered into Aquitaine and the deal made with the Duchy of Aquitaine and the mayor of the palace in Austrasia.
Now, the armies that were taking over Spain at this time were the Umayyad dynasty, sometimes called the Saracens. And for 21 years, they had conquered Spain from Gibraltar all the way up to the very northern port of Spain. And in the 720s, this army crossed over the mountains into Aquitaine, which is modern-day France. Now, Aquitaine is not part of the Merovingian dynasty. Aquitaine is its own independent state. And at this time, Aquitaine is ruled by Otto. And Otto was actually an enemy of the Franks. Charles, in particular, had frequently skirmished with Otto in the Aquitaine regions. Charles, it seemed, wanted to take over these regions for himself.
So Charles, we didn't explain who Charles was. Charles Martel is the grandfather of Charlemagne. He is the head of the Carolingian families at this time. And Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, he is the mayor of the palace. So he's the head of the Carolingian family, essentially.
Actually, an enemy of the Franks. Charles, in particular, had frequently skirmished with Otto in the Aquitaine regions. Charles, it seemed, wanted to take over these regions for himself to make them part of the Frankish Empire. And Otto, therefore, was an enemy to Charles. However, Otto had an even greater concern when the Saracen, or the Umayyad dynasty, crossed over the mountains into the region of Aquitaine. Otto did his best to repel the force. At one point, he manages to have a victory against the Umayyad armies. But before long, he is outnumbered and outmatched, and he is on the run. And of all the people that Otto has to appeal to for help, Otto reaches out to Charles. And Charles, of course, knows that an enemy is one thing, but to have a Muslim army advancing up into Europe creates a greater crisis, and therefore, he and Otto made a decision. Aquitaine, it was decided, would become part of the Frankish Empire. Otto would therefore join forces with Charles, and this joint army would then fight back the Umayyad dynasty.
So Otto flees Aquitaine to the north of France to join forces with Martel, Charles Martel, and recruit him. And he left the Muslims to loot Aquitaine and raid up the countryside is what they did. They felt because they had defeated Otto in that first battle that that they had free reign of France. So they start looting and raiding up the western countryside, heading towards the town of Tours. The town of Tours has a bunch of cathedrals and abbeys, and it was going to be a motherload of booty for the Muslims. So they start heading towards Aquitaine. I mean, start heading out of Aquitaine into northern France, heading toward the town of Tours. And on their way to Tours, they are headed off by Charles Martel and his army, who had taken a position on high ground. And they were there to meet the Muslims. The Muslims were being led by the governor of Al-Andalus at this time, a man by the name of Abdullah al-Rahman. And Charles Martel was badly outnumbered. He was outnumbered, probably by 20 or 30,000 troops. But the fact that he had chosen a position on high ground and he was basically hiding a lot of his army in the forest, he had staked out a great position. He was prepared for the Muslims, and this is how it played out in 732 AD. This is one of the most important battles in human history. Take a listen.
In October of 732, the main body of the Arab forces encountered a large Christian army sitting directly in their path to Tours. Ar-Rahman was a decent commander and realized that Charles Martel outmaneuvered him, choosing the place of the battle. Muslim forces were mainly horsemen, a mix of light and heavy cavalry, many of them properly armored or even mailed, perfectly suited to fight in the open. In contrast, Christian forces consisted mostly of heavy infantry units, battle-hardened through the years of minor fighting on the Frankish border, with the support of a few light levy infantry and light cavalry units. Charles deployed his army between the Vienne and Clain rivers, in the slightly elevated forest, in order to screen his true numbers and minimize the impact of the expected Arab cavalry charges. For 7 days, minor skirmishes took place. Charles Martel was holding good defensive positions and knew that this was his only hope for victory. On the other side, Ar-Rahman waited for the rest of his troops to join him and was quite reluctant to attack the Christians from the front, as he didn't see many of their forces. His hesitations were also caused by subpar Muslim intelligence. He didn't know much about the Franks. Presumably, he didn't even recognize Charles himself, and Martel was fully aware of the Arabs' strengths and weaknesses. The battle finally began on the seventh day, as the Muslims couldn't wait any longer with winter approaching, and their light clothing wasn't enough for the cold European winters. Ar-Rahman trusted the tactical superiority of his cavalry and had them charge repeatedly in order to break Martel's line. But the Franks' tightly packed infantry stood firmly, fending off one Muslim charge after another. It was one of the rare instances where medieval infantry withstood the cavalry assaults, but Charles's soldiers were well motivated and disciplined, and simply trusted Charles as a capable commander. As one medieval source described it, "And in the shock of battle, the men of the north seemed like a sea that cannot be moved. Firmly they stood, one close to another, forming, as it were, a bulwark of ice. And with great blows of their swords, they hewed down the Arabs." Despite the Frankish brave attitude, after numerous charges, some of Ar-Rahman's units managed to break into the Frankish line here and there, aiming to reach Charles's position, but the Franks were able to push them back again, utilizing forces from the second line. Battle was still underway when Duke Odo got behind enemy lines with a small cavalry unit to ravage the Muslim camp, free slaves, retrieve booty, and more importantly, draw off part of his foe. This action heavily impacted subsequent events. Some Arab units still fought the battle, while many of them surprisingly rushed back to save their loot. Ar-Rahman tried to stop his units from an uncoordinated retreat, with little to no effect. It was exactly what Charles had waited for, and he then commanded his forces to pursue and attack the disorganized Arab troops. Many were surrounded and killed, including Ar-Rahman, who still strived to control his army. The Franks didn't pursue their enemies for too long, fearing an ambush. They got back to the forest to treat their wounds and prepare for another day of Umayyad charges, but the next morning, the Arabs didn't renew the battle. Scouts reported that their camp was abandoned. The battle was over.
We don't know that everything that is described in this clip is what actually happened in the battle. The historical records are sparse, and the accounts from the Muslim side differ from the accounts from the Frank side. The the things that we do know is that Charles Martel did take a position on a hill in a forest area, and he repelled repeated attacks by the Muslims trying to break his ranks. We know that the Muslim leader, Al-Rahman, the governor of Al-Nulus, was killed in one of those attempts to break the French ranks. We know that in the middle of the night, the Muslims, after their leader is killed, that they all flee back over the Pyrenees into Spain. We know that this was one of the first defeats that the Muslims had suffered since they first came out of Medina and took over Mecca. They were seen as invincible, particularly in their own eyes. And Muslims downplay the Battle of Tours and say it wasn't significant at all, that they were just, you know, going into France to raid and stake out France, to, you know, they weren't there to invade. But if you look at how they took over Spain, when Tariq went over into Spain, he wasn't there to conquer Spain. He was just there to raid and to stake out Spain, and they ended up taking over Spain. So saying that, oh, you know, we were just in France to raid and to stake out France, and yeah, and then until you end up taking over France. So the significance of the battle and the fact that the Franks, the Christian Franks, repelled and stopped the advance of the Muslim army, I think that it's hugely significant. The Muslims could have taken over France, and they've taken over France. They could have crossed the English Channel into England and taken over England. They could have, you know, taken over all of Europe from France, and they were stopped by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours in 732. Now, this battle was significant and one of the most important battles in human history. That cannot be denied. And the reason that can't be denied is not necessarily because this is Christendom winning a battle against Islam, saving Europe from Islam. That's not why it's one of the most important battles in human history. The reason why it's one of the most important battles in human history is because it's going to give rise to one of the most important kings throughout all of Europe. And he is a Carolingian king, the grandson of Charles Martel. The Merovingian dynasty was still very weak at this point in time. And Charles Martel is going to use the notoriety that he receives from the Battle of Tours to depose the Merovingians and bring the Carolingians to power as the new monarchy. I want you to listen to a little bit of this clip that explains that, and we'll wrap this up and get back into it in the next podcast. And then I have some other stuff that I want to close out this podcast with. But take a listen to this clip.
Now, this is not just any battle, though it is, of course, a significant battle in general, given the size of the troops involved. But rather, this battle, the Battle of Tours, would live on, in the minds of Europeans at least, as the Christian armies had to fight back against the Muslim armies. And so in the long history, the long tortured history, frankly, of Christian and Muslim armies fighting one another, particularly in the Middle Ages, this is seen as one of the first major decisive battles between the two sides. Notice, by the way, that this is several hundred years before the Crusades. People often mistakenly believe that the Crusades were the first time that Muslims and Christians decided to take on political armies and start fighting. Actually, it happened from essentially the very beginning. The Umayyad dynasty had conquered certain parts of Spain, and they had encroached up into Europe, and as a result, the Christian armies led by Charles Martel repelled them. However, putting aside what this means for Christian and Muslim relations throughout the Middle Ages, this battle was hailed by all of Europe as an example of the Frankish power. That Charles Martel had not only displayed prowess in battle against other Europeans and other tribes, but now he had stood up for the faith, and he had repelled the Muslim armies that were coming to conquer and to ravage the church in Europe. In the end, the rise of the Frankish or the Carolingian Empire out of the Merovingians sets the stage for one of the greatest rulers to ever come on the scene in Europe. Charles Martel's grandson was named Charles. And Charles would take the reign and the vision that Charles Martel and Pepin the Short set out for the Frankish dynasty. And he would achieve all of the vision that they had and more. And for that, he would be called Charles the Great, or as he is known to us, Charlemagne.
All right, we're going to talk about Charlemagne in the next podcast. We're going to talk about the deal that the Carolingians make with the Pope to depose the last Merovingian king and bring the Carolingians into power as the new monarchy. I want to play this last clip. This is a clip of a famous 18th century English historian, and this guy is repeating what Edward Gibbon said about the Battle of Tours. Take a listen.
It then came to symbolize for later historians, in particular for the great English historian Edward Gibbon, he saw it as a decisive turning point in the battle between Europe and the Muslim world. And he famously said that if it hadn't been for Charles Martel and Tours, we would now be preaching the Quran in Oxford.
There's definitely some truth to that. The Western Europe was at its weakest point at this point in time. This was the period of time between the end of the Roman Empire and the rise of the Carolingian dynasty. This was the dawn of the early Middle Age. The Merovingian dynasty was weak. The papacy in Rome was weak. The western part of the Roman Empire had long been abandoned by the eastern part of the empire, who were dealing with their own conflicts on the eastern front. The timing for taking Europe was at this point. In the 8th century, the Muslims, if they would have regrouped and sent a larger force into Spain to then attempt a second conquest of France, they might have been successful, because this was the weakest point in Western history. But just 18 years after the Battle of Tours, the Umayyads were conquered themselves by civil war and infighting amongst the Muslims, and the Abbasids come to power, and they lose control of Spain. And then later on, the Charlemagne comes to power, and the Franks are in a much better position to defend against a Muslim invasion. So the timing was everything. If Charles Martel would have lost that battle at Tours, all of Western history might be different. We might be, you know, when we go to hotels, instead of having a King James Bible in our hotel, we may have a Quran in the hotel. We may all be under Sharia law at this point in history if that battle would have gone differently. Who knows? It wasn't celebrated as a great Christian victory back then in the 8th century, but later historians started to recognize the significance of that battle, and I tend to agree with the historians who say that that battle was very significant. So with that, we'll get back into that and the rise of the Carolingians in the next episode. I want to finish out this episode by talking about some current news going on right now. And I want to talk about this meme, this Let's Go Brandon meme, which is absolutely fascinating. This is Gulliver's Travel. This is a satirical criticism of the powers at be, and it could not be more fabulous. I guarantee you the Biden administration is reeling over this Let's Go Brandon meme, because it started with the football games and people showing up at football games chanting F Joe Biden. And take a listen to this clip. This is a little bit of the chants that were going on across stadiums across the country, chanting F Joe Biden is how this meme started. Take a listen. It's great because it all rings together. I mean, you can't say F Trump, F Joe Biden. It just has a ring to it. So that's how it all started. And this story has everything in it, because the Let's Go Brandon is just indicative of everything going on in our society right now, because Let's Go Brandon, I guess this Brandon guy was a race car driver who had just won a race. Brandon Brown is his name. And the people in the stands at this NASCAR event, they're chanting the F Joe Biden chant, and the media tries to cover for Joe Biden, as they always do. And that's how this Let's Go Brandon meme was created. Take a listen. This is the clip with Brandon Brown and the Let's Go Brandon chant, and how this meme evolved out of this. Take a listen.
His first career win. Didn't this look too so rusty awesome. On those burnouts, Brandon. Must be practicing somewhere.
I'm going to play the full interview. Very few people have seen the full interview. People have only seen the cuts where the crowd starts chanting. And people have speculated that this NBC Sports reporter might have really thought that they were chanting Let's Go Brandon. But I want to show why that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, y'all could ask like my neighbors back at Coastal Carolina that I did plenty of burnouts to practice for this moment. Oh my God, this is a dream come true.
Oh my God.
Wow, Talladega winner of the NASCAR. Oh my God, Dad, we did it. Let's go.
Notice how the crowd is not chanting anything.
Race that if you right now, win, it would be incredible. How does the reality of this moment live up to the dream?
Oh my God, this is just everything we've hoped and dreamed for.
No chanting, they're yelling.
Everything I've ever wanted to do is take the trophy home to mom and dad. And oh my God, thank you so much, Larry's Lemonade. Thank you so much, Trade the Chain.
Larry's Lemonade.
Thank you so much, Jabs Construction. Thank you, Mid-Atlantic. Thank you to all of our partners.
Now they start chanting. So the producer is in her ear when they start chanting. And this is the way this stuff works. This wasn't just coming from her. Everything is being produced. That's Let's Go Brandon. That everything is the Truman Show. That's Let's Go Brandon. So they start chanting, and then the producer tells her to cover for the chant. Take a listen.
Jabs Construction. Thank you, Mid-Atlantic. Thank you to all of our partners. Oh my God, it's just such an unbelievable moment.
Brandon, you also told me, as you can hear the chants from the crowd, let's go, Brandon. You told me.
So the producer tells her, you know, we have to address these chants that are starting, F Joe Biden. So she has to address it and play it off. So not only do they tell her to cover for this and to say that they're saying, let's go, Brandon, to try to make the people at home, to try to convince the people at home that you are hearing, let's go, Brandon. And if you're not hearing, let's go, Brandon, you're a conspiracy theorist. But the camera even cuts to the crowd. And she tries to make her viewers believe that they are saying, let's go, Brandon. And this is, like I said, indicative of everything that is going on in our society right now. Let's go, Brandon has morphed into this meme that is a criticism on the establishment. The media included, all of the lies that you tried to tell us and that you're trying to convince us of and tell us that we're conspiracy theorists if we don't hear, let's go, Brandon. And I'm sure there's some, you know, of these zombies out there that are just like, well, maybe he is saying, maybe they are saying, let's go, Brandon. Well, you know, my truth is they're saying, let's go, Brandon. This is the postmodern perspective. My truth is that they're saying, let's go, Brandon. Your truth can be another truth. They're obviously not saying, let's go, Brandon. But they're convincing you, they want to convince you that at home, that they are saying, let's go, Brandon, that let's go, Brandon is real. And that is what this is all about. That's the beauty of this meme. And I hope we can keep it going for as long as possible. Let's listen again.
Trade the chain. Thank you so much, Jabs Construction. Thank you, Mid-Atlantic. Thank you to all of our partners. Oh my God, it's just such an unbelievable moment.
Brandon, you also told me, as you can hear the chants from the crowd, let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon. Let's go, Brandon. And then she just keeps going like, yeah, that's what they're saying. Let's go, Brandon. I'm going to convince you at home that they're saying, let's go, Brandon. And even if she was, you know, just trying to cover for, you know, the fact that there's, you know, profanity, that they're saying F Joe Biden, that's the big deal. I mean, you're still lying. It doesn't matter what your reasoning is behind you lying to us. You're lying to us. That's your modus operandi. That is what you do, mainstream corporate media. You lie to us. You're always trying to convince us, let's go, Brandon. On Bill Maher's show a couple of weeks ago, he had Killer Mike on the show, and he brought this up, and he was trying to be, you know, clutch his pearls. Oh, my God, they're saying F Joe Biden. Can you believe how undignified these people are to say F Joe Biden? And then Killer Mike reminds him that a lot of people said F Trump. Well, you didn't say anything about that on your show, Bill.
That's what I'm saying. Aggressive. We don't want to start arresting each other, especially since the mood. I mean, have you seen that people are chanting at football games, fuck Joe Biden? Like, it was at the Jet game. That's New York.
Yeah, fuck the Jets.
No, I'm sorry. That was for my tour manager. I love you, Christian. It's not fuck the Jets.
Well, as a Jet fan my whole life, fuck the Jets. Because, no, they won last week. The yeah, Giants on the Jets. But, I mean, New York football is sad. But I always stick with my town. Okay. But of course, they did it in Talladega. You know, I mean, Ricky Bobby was, I'm sure, out there. Screaming, but that's Alabama. But even then, where's the pushback from decent people? I'm sure.
Where's the pushback from decent people? Do you remember how decent the left was when Donald Trump was in office? Oh, we have to all of a sudden get decent because Joe Biden is so decent. No, he's a tyrant. He's a Nazi tyrant, is what Joe Biden is.
people in those stands, even if they're conservative or didn't vote for Joe Biden, who don't want to hear fuck Joe Biden as a chant. I mean, lock her up was bad enough. But now we're fuck Joe Biden as a chant and we just let that happen. This is a dangerous.
Well, the First Amendment still matters. And even though you don't.
Thank you, Killer Mike.
People saying fuck unless there's some real good fucking going on. You got to say to yourself, Joe kind of parades himself as a tough guy, has a couple German shepherds, tells black people, you ain't black if you don't vote for me. And under rap rules, you can get a fuck you, cuz. And I'm not necessarily saying that's what you want to do to the president. But I heard a lot of fuck Donald Trumps in the Atlanta protest.
Thank you. I heard a lot of it, too. I heard a lot of it on Trump when Trump was in office. And now you're clutching your pearls, Bill Maher. I'm so glad that Killer Mike called him out on this and told him that, yeah, I mean, sometimes presidents deserve an F you. And Joe Biden happens to be one of these presidents. This whole idea that Joe Biden is this sweet, nice, compassionate guy who is just, you know, basically a reincarnation of Jimmy Carter in spirit, not in replicating his disastrous administration, because that's true. But, you know, the idea that Joe Biden is in spirit like Jimmy Carter is ridiculous. That's Let's Go Brandon. That's not the truth. That's Let's Go Brandon. Now, this Let's Go Brandon thing, it kicked off, and it's awesome because instead of the vulgar, F Joe Biden, Let's Go Brandon has kicked off. And like I said, it's a lot larger than Joe Biden. And even kids can get in on the Let's Go Brandon meme. And that's what makes it great. Grandmothers and, you know, people who don't use the F word, everybody can get in on Let's Go Brandon now. And this thing is fantastic. This was a kid at another race, and he was doing the start your engines before the race. And take a listen to this kid.
They're going to help kick this thing off. All right, guys, ready? In 3, 2, 1.
Drivers, start your engines.
Let's go, Brandon.
It's awesome. It is so awesome. You know, even kids can get in on it. It's beautiful. And sometimes God, the universe, whatever, gives you something and it's just like, mwah. And that's what this Let's Go Brandon is, because again, it is indicative of everything going on. The big lie, Let's Go Brandon. January 6th insurrection, Let's Go Brandon. This rap song is number one, I think, on iTunes. If it's not number one, it's one of the top downloaded songs on iTunes over the last week. And this guy just, you know, made a little song with a couple of bars and a catchy hook.
Let's go, Brandon. Hey.
People
let's
are downloading
Brandon.
It.
Hey. Let's go, let's hey. Go.
Let's get to the hook. Now, that's pretty much the hook right there.
You know what they saying,
ho? These are the bars.
You know what they saying, though? Hey, you know what they... Woo! Yeah. You know what they... Yeah. Hey. And I say it with a passion. As I pull off in the Aston. Don't nobody like his ass, huh? Tried to cover up and tell the people, go, Brandon. But we know what they saying, though. You can hear the chant in every post.
People are downloading this, and this guy's making some change. I'm glad. You know, there was the F Donald Trump song. You remember that? Maybe not, because not many people heard the F Donald Trump song. It didn't have nearly the popularity as this song, because this Let's Go Brandon thing, it has morphed into this larger than life meme. It's bigger than Joe Biden. It's more a criticism of the establishment, particularly the mainstream media, trying to sell us Let's Go Brandon. Now, last week, we got news that Katie Couric sold us some Let's Go Brandon. By omission, she did an interview with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg criticized Colin Kaepernick and the Black Lives Matter protests. As a matter of fact, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said some things about the Black Lives Matter protests that could have come directly from the mouth of Donald Trump. Like, if I would ask you, tell you what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said and say, hey, did Donald Trump say this or did Ruth Bader Ginsburg? You'd probably say that Donald Trump is the one who said it. But no, it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Katie Couric hid that from us and tried to sell us a little Let's Go Brandon. Take a listen to this clip.
Former Today Show host Katie Couric has admitted to cutting quotes out of an interview with Ruth Bader Ginsburg that she did back in 2016, where the SCOTUS judge said that kneeling during the national anthem shows a, quote, contempt for a government that has made it possible for their parents and grandparents to live a decent life. Social media users were outraged that Couric chose to withhold this from the public to protect Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. But she openly shared the moral dilemma in her new book.
Moral dilemma. Hilarious. Let's go, Brandon. She had a moral dilemma about telling the truth about, if she would have told us that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had that opinion, that could have helped heal the country. I mean, more people would have said, hey, you know what? If Ruth Bader Ginsburg can have that opinion, maybe it's not so bad that Trump has that opinion. Maybe I'm not so different than my neighbor who thinks that it's ridiculous to allow people to go looting stores and burning down banks and destroying cities. You know, maybe because Ruth Bader Ginsburg has that opinion, it's not a far right opinion. But no, Katie Couric sold you some Let's Go Brandon. Now, Barry Weiss, she used to be with the New York Times. She was on Brian Stelzer's show on CNN on Sunday, and her interview with Brian Stelzer has gone viral. She rips Brian Stelzer, and everything that she is ripping him about here is all Let's Go Brandon. Take a listen to this interview what Brian Stelzer is doing with Barry Weiss.
You write, there are tens of millions of Americans who aren't on the hard left or the hard right who feel the world has gone mad. So in what ways has the world gone mad?
The world has gone mad, Brian Stelzer, when you try to tell me, when I'm watching a group of people chant F Joe Biden, the world has gone mad when you and your cohorts, when you try to convince me that they're saying, let's go, Brandon, that's when the world has gone mad. But I'll let Barry Weiss speak for herself.
Well, you know, when you have the chief reporter on the beat of COVID for the New York Times talking about how questioning or pursuing the question of the lab leak is racist.
Let's go, Brandon.
When you're not able to say out loud and in public that there are differences between men and women.
Let's go, Brandon.
When we're not allowed to acknowledge that rioting is rioting and it is bad, and that silence is not violence, but violence is violence.
Let's go, Brandon.
When we're not able to say that Hunter Biden's laptop is a story worth pursuing.
Let's go, Brandon.
When in the name of progress, young school children, as young as kindergarten, are being separated in public schools because of their race, and that is called progress rather than segregation.
Let's go, Brandon.
There are dozens of examples that I could share with you and with
and
your
you
viewers.
And you often say, you say
everyone
aloud.
Everyone sort of knows this, and
you say we're not allowed,
it's the
we're
chasm
not able.
Between...
Who's the people stopping the conversation? Who
this
are
this guy's acting like he's clueless. Who's the people stopping the conversation? Who's the people who actually prevented the New York Post from posting an article about Hunter Biden's laptop before the election? Who's the people who keep telling us that that President Trump said neo-Nazis were fine people? Who are the people who keep pushing? You don't know Brian Stelzer. You don't know who they are.
not allowed. We're not able. Who's the people stopping the conversation? Who are
they? It's the people trying to convince us that the same people who are trying to convince us that the crowd was saying, let's go, Brandon. That's who we're talking about, Brian Stelzer. We're talking about NBC. We're talking about CNN. We're talking about CBS. We're talking about Twitter. We're talking about Facebook. We're talking about YouTube. We're talking about ABC Disney. That's who we're talking about. You're acting like you don't know who's pushing the Let's Go Brandon? It's hilarious. Listen to more Barry Weiss here.
People that work at networks, frankly, like the one I'm speaking on right now, who try
Thank you,
and
claim Barry.
That, you know, it was racist.
Look at his face. If you haven't seen this, I'll put it in the show notes. He's like, moi? Me? We at CNN, we don't do no Let's Go Brandon over here. Everything that we do on CNN is the bona fide truth. It's hilarious.
Public theory. It was, but I mean,
who
let's
said
just
that
take
at
an
CNN?
Example.
But I'm just saying, that when you
who
say
Who said that at CNN? Who said that the lab leak theory was not valid theory that should have been pursued? No one said that at CNN, Brian Stelzer.
Now, who try and claim that, you know, it was racist to investigate the lab leak theory. It was.
But
I mean,
who
let's
said
just
that
take
at
an
CNN?
Example.
But I'm just saying that when you say allowed, I just think it's a provocative thing you say. You say we're not allowed to talk about these things, but they're all over the internet. I can Google them.
Brian,
I can find them everywhere. I've
heard about Listen to that. They're all over the internet. We don't have to report on it on the news channels, but it's all over the internet. Well, how about if I go get my COVID-19 information from the internet, Brian? Or my vaccine information from the internet. Is that okay? Meanwhile, you have Google. They manipulate search engine results. They have total control over that. You have the Facebook and the Twitters censoring stuff that they don't like. But go to the internet. It's all over the internet. It's the Truman Show, people. It's Let's Go Brandon. All around you. There's this picture going around the internet now because the shelves are empty in stores because of the supply chain crises. I'm doing air quotes, supply chain crises. They have pictures of food. The shelves are empty, but they have pictures of food that they are putting up over the shelves so you don't see the empty shelves, and there's pictures of food. That is Let's Go Brandon. I want to correct one of the things that I said at the beginning of the podcast about the United States and the peaceful transfer of power that we've enjoyed over 240 years nearly a peaceful transfer of power. That's not entirely true. There was a very violent transfer of power that took place in 1963, in the fall of 1963, in Dallas. And it was violent, but it only was a few sniper shots from several rifles, maybe, perhaps several rifles, at least one rifle, we know. And that was a transfer of power. People don't really understand that. That's why we're dealing with, doesn't matter if you vote for Democrats or Republicans, Carol Quigley said in Tragedy and Hope that the two parties, the Democrats and the Republican parties, that the idea that they should be different, one from the right and one from the left, is a foolish idea. Only something that a academic would say, or doctrinaire, I think he says in the quote, that the two parties should be identical so we can throw the rascals out at any elections. And that's what you see going on. You see a continuation of government, the same policy going on no matter who you vote for over and over again for years. You have seen this continuation of government. It's all one big oligarchy establishment, and the emperor has no clothes. the appearance of a democratic election and a change of power, transfer of power from one to another, that's all Let's Go Brandon. That's all Let's Go Brandon. It's not real. And I just wanted to make that correction that since 1963, which there was a violent transfer of power that took place, the head of state was assassinated in 1963 in Dallas, Texas. And there has been a transfer of power, but they didn't do it overtly. They still kept the pitcher over the shelves. They still kept that veneer of a peaceful transfer. That's why you're dealing with the deep state and all of that right now, is because there was a transfer of power. I want to play this clip from Joe Biden. This is more Let's Go Brandon. This is a speech that he did last week at the University of Connecticut. And this speech was written for him. He's just, reading the lines. Or maybe he contributed to this. Who knows? But it's hard to know if he believes the Let's Go Brandon, or if he's trying to make us believe the Let's Go Brandon, but this is absolutely some Let's Go Brandon. This man has implemented the most draconian medical mandate in the history of the United States. People are losing their livelihoods, their careers, their lives over what this guy is doing. And take a listen to this speech that he gave at the University of Connecticut last week.
Dad used to talk about, as a student of the Holocaust, what a tragedy it was that we didn't bomb the railroad tracks toward the end of the war. How wrong it was that we turned away the St. Louis, a ship full of Jewish refugees from Europe. He believed passionately the only way we could make real the promise of never again was to keep reminding ourselves of what had happened. And how so many people otherwise thought themselves decent people rationalized that it really wasn't happening. We didn't know what was going on. Because they weren't turning on the gas valve, they had no responsibility. That's why, if you'll again excuse a point of personal privilege, when each of my children, and now my grandchildren, turn the age of 15, the first thing I've done, my word is a Biden, is put them on an aircraft and fly to Dachau, one at a time, at age 15. Work sets you free as you go through the entrance.
But that's not Dachau, that's Auschwitz. Auschwitz is in Poland.
I wanted to see the lovely homes that were right up against the fence line with their beautiful roofs. People living in there rationalized that it's not me.
Not me doing the vaccine mandates. It's not me making people lose their jobs.
What's going on in there? I wanted them to see the ability of the human mind to rationalize
why the Navy SEALs have to be kicked out of the Navy. Rationalize why career policemen have to quit their jobs.
To turn it around, unlike other countries, is because they faced it head on, acknowledged. So let me say it again. Nuremberg was unlike anything that ever came before. It was not about vengeance. It was about accountability. For only acknowledging the truth can we prevent the repetition of atrocities which are happening now.
They're happening right now. They're happening right now. Nuremberg, yes, it's happening right now. Medical tyranny happening right now under you, sir. Under you. That's why they're chanting F Joe Biden in the stadiums. That's why everybody is talking about the Let's Go Brandon, because this is the Let's Go Brandon. You right now are doing it. It's happening right now. This is what Joe Biden said, but not only Joe Biden, the Speaker of the House and Joe Biden's administration, about vaccine mandates when he was still using the carrot. This is when the carrot was in play. The carrot hadn't been in play for a long time. I told you, you remember when they were using that terminology, the carrot and the stick? This is what they were all. Fauci, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi. This was the narrative when they were still using the carrot. But now it's the stick. Take a listen.
I don't think it should be mandatory. I wouldn't demand to be mandatory, but I would do everything in my power. It's like I don't think masks have to be made mandatory nationwide.
Can we mandate vaccines across the country? No, that's not a role that the federal government, I think, even has the power to make.
We cannot require someone to be vaccinated. That's just not what we can do. It is a matter of privacy to know who is or who isn't.
No, definitely not. You don't want to mandate and try and force anyone to take a vaccine. We've never done that. We don't want to be mandating from the federal government to the general population. It would be unenforceable and not appropriate.
And not appropriate. That was Dr. Fauci, if you didn't recognize his voice. What changed? What's changed? It's the little okie doke, the Let's Go Brandon that they're pulling on you. It's deceptive. It's diabolical. It's 100% evil what these people are doing. But like Joe Biden said, you justify it. It's not me. It's not me making the mandates. It's not me forcing people out of their livelihoods. It's not me. It's not me. And then the vaccine companies, they're the biggest advertiser on some of these networks that are pushing the Let's Go Brandon. And the ethics around this whole thing is just, I can't believe people are falling for it. Well, I'm getting in on the Let's Go Brandon, and a lot of people are selling shirts. A lot of people are selling other Let's Go Brandon stuff. I love this meme. I want to keep it going. And I'm going to be selling bumper stickers to support the podcast. If you want to do some holiday shopping for some stocking stuffers, I have almost 30 different bumper sticker designs and some other things on my website. Go to the website and you'll find that. It's probably going to be a day or two before it's up, but get yourself some stickers, get some other stuff, and let's keep the Let's Go Brandon going. You know, when the Muslims crossed over into Spain, they were migrating. They're migrating, just like Columbus. When Columbus went to the New World, they were just going over into Spain to check it out. And there were some indigenous people there. There were indigenous people in Spain, and there were indigenous people who were already in France. And those people decided to fight, particularly the people in France. The people in Spain did too. They took Spain back from the Muslims. But they decided to use that toxic masculinity and fight for what was theirs. And the rest is history. Who do you want to be? I'll be back with episode 100. And it's going to be here soon. And have some big things planned for the podcast. You guys be here. Thank you so much for listening.